Take me whole, she says, or go elsewhere for spiritual strength and comfort. Her priests forbid the practice of spiritism everywhere on the ground I have mentioned. But is this spiritism the only study to which the Roman Church objects? Let us see what she demands besides 1. The belief in the existence of a personal devil. 2. The entire and unqualified disbelief in the evolution of the physical body of man from lower types of life. 3. The belief in the verbal inspiration of the Bible, that every word of it is dictated by God Almighty, that the human element in its phraseology and ideas is wholly eliminated. I will not waste time by discussing, 1. As to, 2. The evolution of man from lower forms is an actually proved fact, like the chemical elements of water, no educated person doubts it for a moment. The Church might as well demand that her children should not learn to read and write. All I have to say as regards, 3, is that, if this is true, the Church has no right to say that only evil spirits commune with man, for this wonderful book is full of spiritism from cover to cover. And, if all the spirits with whom I have communicated are from the Father of Lies, the spirit who released Peter from prison must have come from the same source. In the Bible there are examples of good and evil spirits, sometimes coming 3 at a time, as to Abraham, sometimes with trumpets, as in the present day. There are numerous examples of clairaudience, clairvoyance, inspirational writing, inspirational speaking, of tests, of telekinesis. In fact, all the phenomena known to the modern investigator. The Roman Church will not succeed in persuading her children to shut their eyes and ears either to the teachings of Charles Darwin or to the rapidly accumulating evidence of spiritism. I wish the pontiff had issued such an injunction as this. The investigation of spiritistic phenomena is dangerous for nervous, excitable people, who have not prepared themselves for it by study and contemplation, and should only be undertaken with great caution. This would have been a wise course to take, and could not have failed to effect much good, for there is evil in the abuse of everything, in spiritism as much as in whiskey, and, assuredly, there are people who ought never to touch either. I need not say that I utterly deny the truth of the Roman Catholic doctrine of spiritism being the insinuating work of devils. If I thought there was a grain of sense in it, I should not be writing this book. It is from my private records chiefly that I am able flatly to contradict the Roman emissaries. It would require an army of detective devils to find out so much about my life and friends as has been related to me in the direct voice at Detroit, Michigan. Sooner or later, a false statement would be made, and the fraud would be discovered. The communications made to me all fit in with one another admirably, and tell of events covering the space of half a century. Even these alleged devils have their limitations. Such a scheme of lying must betray itself in the course of time. And, I ask, what could be the motive of such a conspiracy of wickedness? Can it be to the interest of devils to lead a man up, step by step, to a knowledge of immortality? Would it not be more to the interest of these alleged spiritual desperados to impress upon him that annihilation was the truer doctrine? Yes, replies the Roman Catholic. But while appearing to you in the guise of beneficent teachers and angelic visitants, these devils, in whom we believe, are leading you away from the orthodox doctrine that man can only be saved through the blood of Christ and by His grace. No visitor from the spirit world, as you know, ever teaches that man can only attain salvation through Christ. It is this view of the Roman Catholics which caused me to say above that their objections to the investigation and practice of spiritism cannot be ignored. For it truly represents their honest belief, and this belief is shared by thousands in the Anglican Church. It is quite correct to say that no visitor from the spirit world teaches that salvation can be obtained only through Christ. They teach, universally, that man is his own savior, and can obtain happiness or suffer misery only through his own acts. This, of itself, is evidence in favor of the genuineness of mediums. Undoubtedly it would be more popular, and bring more grist to the mill, if the controls and other spirits adhered to the theology of the Western churches, but they do not, either in Protestant or Roman Catholic countries. Over the whole area where spiritistic influence is felt, the teaching, in all essentials, is Unitarian. Jesus Christ is revered, and his holy example is not disputed, but no hope is held out to man that he can progress through any other channel than that of his own efforts. His sins are not forgiven on account of any sacrifice of the sinless. He reaps what he sows. Deathbed repentance is of no avail. He cannot escape the consequences of breaking the laws of nature, and he carries with him into the next life an indelible record of all he has done in the present state of consciousness. At the same time, hope is held out to him. If he makes reparation, where such is possible, for breaking the golden rule, and has a sincere desire to rise, he will be afforded facilities for doing so. Every soul goes to its own place. No priest can avert a man's destiny, he can only avert it himself by obeying the laws of nature in this life, and doing his best in the next state to rise higher in spiritual development. It is not surprising, then, that the Catholic Church continues to make every effort to prevent her children from becoming spiritists. To be consistent, it cannot do otherwise. Its opposition cannot affect the ultimate truth. For all we know, it may be a useful drag on over-enthusiasm, and one of the many instruments used by Providence for postponing the period when all men shall come in, voluntarily, to believe the truths of Spiritism. In the meantime, nothing is to be gained by trying to convert churchmen or materialists. By their mental attitude of hostility, they can prevent manifestations from taking place, and thus nullify the benefits which otherwise would be gained by earnest investigators. If a man can really bring himself to believe that the manifestations of all spirits are the work of devils, he is unfit to appreciate the delicate and gentle phenomena which are seen and heard through the agency of good psychics. This record of facts in the experience of one investigator is no place for a discussion of different forms of religion. All phases of worship not accompanied by barbarity are to be respected, if sincere. The great American poet said, "The reign of violence is dead, or dying surely from the world, while love triumphant reigns instead, and in a brighter sky where it his blessed banners are unfurled." And most of all, thank God for this, the war and waste of clashing creeds now ends in words and not in deeds, and no one suffers loss or bleeds for thoughts that men call heresies. And again, not to one church alone, but seven, the voice prophetic spake from heaven, and unto each the promise came, diversified, but still the same, "For him that overcometh are the new name written on the stone, the raiment white, the crown, the throne, and I will give him the morning star." I expect that all places of worship where hundreds are gathered together for prayer and praise, though the rubric may be feeble and the liturgy erroneous, are thronged with the good spirits of the departed. My relative A. tells me he is conscious of their presence in any earnest congregation. He becomes cold as they draw power from him, but this feeling is succeeded, as the service closes, by one of ineffable calm and peace, impossible, adequately, to describe. It is desirable to point out that the divines of the Anglican Church are not, by any means, agreed as to the nature of the vicarious sufferings of Christ. One eminent churchman, Archbishop McGee, wrote as follows in his small work, The Atonement, p. 103, "This idea of Christ suffering the same, or an equivalent, penalty with that which is due by us, and this suffering being a satisfaction to the justice of God, is wholly indefensible. At any rate, I cannot attempt to defend it. Nay, I go further, and I say that this whole idea of transferring certain exact and mathematically equal amounts of moral suffering from one person to another, as if they were so many weights in a scale or so many chemical quantities in a laboratory, seems to me unthinkable. I cannot even imagine it. Persons are not things, personal feelings, states, conditions cannot be made to change places as if they were material substances. He who takes my place in suffering does not, and cannot, take my sufferings. These cannot be the same for him as they would be for me, simply because he is not I. In his place I should not feel precisely as he did, I might feel more, I might feel less, I should certainly feel differently. My penalty, therefore, cannot be transferred to him. And as to such transference being an act of justice, I wholly deny it." The clumsy and grotesque analogy so often employed to explain it, that, namely, of a schoolmaster, who has threatened punishment for some fault, accepting a strong boy, who has not committed that fault, for punishment in the place of some sickly boy who has, and then boasting he has kept his word, and that his justice is thereby fully satisfied, seems to me a downright insult to our understanding. Coming, as they do, from an Archbishop of York, these are important words. Dr. McGee denies that the alleged vicarious sufferings of Christ expiated the sins of men. We find in this little work of his that he believes that the death of Christ had some effect in reconciling the Almighty to sinful man. What that effect was he professes himself to be entirely ignorant. In the chapter on the atonement in Lux Mundi, a writer takes just the opposite view. The fact is, it was not Christ, but Paul, who insisted upon the mystical reasons of the death of the great teacher becoming a matter of dogma in the new church. All the theories revolving round the crucifixion are in a hopeless muddle. So, also, are the doctrines relating to the Holy Ghost, who is said in the Nicene Creed to be the Father of Jesus, and yet to proceed from him. No such contradictory doctrines are found to come from spirits. All over the civilized world they agree that man cannot shelter himself behind either God or man to rid himself of the consequences of his acts. Effects strictly follow causes, and he has to suffer for injuring his fellow mortal, or himself, more or less according to the motive of his actions and the degree of the wrong accomplished. Some ministers of the Anglican Church believe in Spiritism, and are daily trying to reconcile its evidences with church dogmas. It is a very difficult task, but I think it is quite safe to predict that Christianity, as at present taught, will before many years have to surrender much of its outworn dogma, and assimilate the teachings of the invisible entities around us. Thoughtful men are beginning to see that the resurrection of a god is no encouragement to a man, whereas the spiritual resurrection of a man who possessed godlike attributes affords hope that other men may be equally favored. There have been many avatars in history. Many were born on December 25th, and of a virgin, many were crucified, or suffered ignominious deaths, many arose again from the grave, and disappeared in a miraculous manner. Jesus of Nazareth was the last of the avatars. As archetypal man, his life, death, and spiritual resurrection are of the greatest value to mankind, all can try and achieve to his exalted level. But if he were supernatural, of a type lifted infinitely higher than those he came to teach, his ministry can have no permanent effect. Psychical research is yet in its infancy, and it would be sheer dogmatism to attempt any forecast of what its future may bring forth. So far, only individuals here and there have been favored with tests which enable them to arrive at positive conviction of the existence of the next state of consciousness. But there are a few points in its study which appear to be fairly plain, standing out in so conspicuous a manner that there is small probability of their being refuted in any future advance of knowledge. One is that investigators are dealing with intelligences who are functioning in more than three dimensions, and who cannot describe, except symbolically, what are their occupations. When they enter the atmosphere of the earth plane, they recur to earth speech, thought, and actions. If well practiced by constant visits, they are able to do this so effectively as to make the illusion that they occupy an earth body quite complete. It is amazing. At the same time, they perform acts which demonstrate that they have powers not limited to our three dimensions. They appear and disappear in the fraction of a second. They precipitate a picture complete in every detail, though the face of another canvas is locked to it, dematerialize flowers, pass ponderable substances through walls, form as phantoms through which the observer can walk, carry about articles in a room, sing without a throat, whistle without a break, and talk for as much as an hour without the faltering of a note. A few weeks before these lines were written, I was sitting one morning in a dark room with Mrs. Rhett, between two tables. Upon one of them was a large bowl full of roses, on the other, behind me, were vases full of carnations. A phantom approached me, and talked through the trumpet. I then heard the roses in the bowl in front of me being moved. After an interval of about 5 minutes, a rose with a very thorny stem was put into my hand. When the lights were switched on, a rose and a carnation were found on the floor at my feet. The carnation must have been taken from the vase behind me, yet I heard no disturbance of the flowers or any other noise at my back. The flower in my hand was the best out of the bowl in front of me, a full-blown red rose. It is a frequent jibe that spirits do not explain to us what they are doing. How can they? Let the reader imagine himself trying to explain how he is occupied to a two-dimensional being. As an instance, let us suppose that he takes a sheet of paper, and asks his two-dimensional friend how he would join two corners of the paper diagonally. The latter could only know of one method, that of sensing a line from one of the corners to the other, but the reader, operating in three dimensions, knows the better way. He joins the two points by bending the sheet of paper. Now, how could he explain this to the being who only understands length and breadth? It is impossible. I have asked numerous questions of spirits about physical phenomena. The answer is ever the same: we cannot explain to you how these things are done in terms you are able to understand. You cannot learn how they are performed until you come over. As a matter of fact, some things are explained fairly well. My guide, after she passed to spirit life, so she tells me, was employed for many earth years in the kindergarten, a part of the celestial sphere, teaching children. She is now studying painting and music, when not employed watching and impressing my family. This is a general statement. If I persisted in my inquiry, she would not be able to explain what sort of painting or what sort of music. We may be sure it does not mean exactly what the same answer would imply on earth. I have been frequently informed that time does not exist in the spirit world, and I expect that space is a very different conception to what we understand by that word. If past, present, and future are all one, second sight, prophecy, and prescience of all sorts do not appear as if they should be so difficult to spirits. Several curious queries and reflections arise in the mind of an investigator as he delves into this subject. The spirits invariably express the greatest pleasure in coming to you, and thank you for giving them the opportunity of communicating with the earth plane. Why is this? Be spirits manifesting for the first time always have a set speech, apparently got up before entering the earth's atmosphere. This delivered, they are done, and if they are plied with questions, they are unable to answer intelligibly, and depart. After they have been to see you, say, 20 times, they acquire a facility of speech which is truly wonderful. They can argue, combat your opinions, and give their own, often, in the end, saying, well, very likely you know best. See, if you ask a question as to something definite, such as a name or place, the intelligences are often unable to reply clearly. Why? If there is undue anxiety on the part of a spirit to impart knowledge and the sitter to receive it, there is generally a failure. Spirits behave at first just like stammerers on the earth plane. You may get the information you want another time, when you are not expecting any test. If the spirit is a familiar one who has visited you many times, the same difficulty is not experienced. Everything done is done gently. No one is ever really injured when in company with good psychics. Trumpets may be dropped, articles of furniture may be moved, you may be touched, slapped, even struck sharply, but never permanently hurt. F spirits cannot tell anything about a sphere much higher than that in which they dwell themselves. This is the more curious as there is little doubt, from what we are told, that those in different spheres and realms can, within limitations, reside together. G. A spirit seldom gives its working name on earth until after many visits. Suppose a spirit had, on earth, the names William Ernest Forward, and he was called William or Willie by his friend when he was alive, he will give the name Ernest. For a spirit to give his surname on first visit is rare. H. Touching or seizing a phantom or form is sometimes very injurious to the medium, at others it does no harm whatever. I. Cheating by the sitter upsets proceedings, and puts an end to genuine phenomena. J. Spirits attach importance to the third day after physical death. K. Infants who pass over appear to lose nothing by the loss of earth experience. L. When sitting with good mediums you never hear a harsh word, a dogmatic opinion, an unkind criticism, or a false sentiment. M. Spirits cannot rise in the spheres or become happy if the relatives they leave behind feel exaggerated sorrow and emotion on their departure. and it is becoming more and more evident that undeveloped spirits can be assisted to advance in the next state by being brought back to the earth plane for visits. Oh, the spirit of the red man is of great use in seances. This is a very unexpected result of our intercourse with spirits. I have often asked for an explanation. They say, every good act assists the advance of a spirit in the spheres, and manifestations which help to prove to mortals that life beyond the grave is a fact are good acts. By coming into contact with relatives we have left behind, talking to them, and so forth, we are afterwards better able to impress them silently in their own homes. We, therefore, thank them for giving us these opportunities. Be it is very natural that a spirit manifesting for the first time should experience great difficulty in making itself known. The atmosphere of the earth plane is, to them, dense and bewildering, and, apparently, the only way they can manage is to get a speech of a few words ready before they enter it. They improve at every visit, until, eventually, they can converse as easily as if they were mortal. Many cannot succeed at all, some are barely able to make themselves known, while, on the other hand, I have known a few who remain several minutes at the first interview and answer a few questions. See definite questions as to names, dates, and places appear to create a positive condition, which upsets vibrations, until the spirit is well trained by three or four visits. I have many exceptions in my notes, such as Galileo, Stone, and Sir Isaac Newton. But, speaking generally, spirits cannot converse intelligently without considerable practice. De whatever doubts we may have on many points, there are none on this. Passivity on the part of a sitter is absolutely essential to success. I have noticed many failures due to the disturbance of the minds of sitters, and I conjecture that calmness is just as necessary on the other side. Either delicacy of phenomena is a constant wonder to me. Trumpets are dropped on a table or the floor often from as high as 10 or 12 feet, they alight without doing any injury to the sitters, or to articles on the table, or in the room. It is rare to find even a novice frightened at any séance. This is my experience. A spirit in, say, the third sphere can tell you nothing of spirits in the fifth or sixth. I believe the motive of this is, generally, to expel from the sitter's mind the explanation of mind reading, and to give him confidence in the genuineness of the communication. It may be, sometimes, that, like the stammerer, he cannot get out the name he ought to pronounce, and gives the other on the spur of the moment. Here, I think, the motive is everything. If a sitter seizes a form from reasons of hostility to the manifestation, and hoping to discover fraud, he will do the psychic considerable injury. If, however, he acts without any but friendly and sympathetic feelings towards the medium, and purely to study the degree of substantiality of the forms, the controls impress the medium's wife to make no opposition to his experiment. No harm was done to Mr. Johnson by any of my attempts to solve this mystery of science, and, owing to the kind confidence shown in me by his wife, I made discoveries which, incidentally, prove the integrity of everything that happens when her husband is in a trance. My friend Greyfeather, his control, has never reproached me, but has even come over to England to manifest his goodwill. I lying and cheating by a sitter invariably spoil phenomena. Giving false names, refusing to acknowledge spirit friends when they appear, laying traps, talking in a disparaging sense of what is going on, restlessness and mental suspicion, all tend to kill the efforts of the controls to prove the power of the invisible intelligences around us. Two or three times I have been told that the spirit of man generally cognizes his new environment on the third day after physical death. Once a lady came to me and told me that she had been able to impress her sister in earth life with the conviction that she was alive on the third day. I made inquiries 2 months later, and found that this was true. We know that it is not always so. As will be shown in the appendix to this work, it may be weeks or months, possibly years, before the dead are awake. Very rarely, they manifest on the same day, still more rarely, the same hour, even minute. But, I take it, the story of the resurrection of Jesus is not without its esoteric meaning, like many other narratives in both the Old and New Testaments. Okay, during my investigations, a sad accident happened to an infant in my family, causing its sudden death. Mrs. Rhett arrived in England a few days after, and, in her presence, I enjoyed intercourse with my relatives, who told me in the direct voice of its reception into the next state. There were several communications, but the gist of them all was this: this little one was removed for a purpose. Though physically normal, it was psychically abnormal. Had it lived to maturity, it would have been a highly developed sensitive. It loses nothing by the loss of earth experience. It will grow up in the kindergarten, a part of what is termed celestial life, where it will develop as speedily as if it had remained on earth. In one respect, that of articulate speech, it will develop even more rapidly. I cannot understand this, and simply record what the voice told me. Infants in spirit life, in this celestial sphere, grow up entirely unsullied by earthly emotions. They are the angels of God. They know nothing of love as mortals understand that word, until, at some future time, they may find their soul mate. The infant for whom you mourn is in the charge of, naming a near relative, who will educate it. At present it is too young to be taught, but it is sufficient understanding to know that it is loved. You will be informed, from time to time, as to how it is progressing. I was enjoined to tell this to the father, and to say that his child was apostrophe without a scar. It was etherealized, and brought into the room and laid amongst a heap of narcissi. This may not be the experience of every investigator. It is mine. The only discordant notes I have ever heard are the impatient exclamations of spirit visitors when they cannot make themselves heard or understood. Some of them seem to think that there is no difficulty on our side. They feel sure they have given their name distinctly when I have heard nothing but a blurred sound. I have noticed that my friends carefully avoid judging anybody, and change the subject if a question is asked to which the only answer can be one involving censure on their part. Only once have I heard my guide depart from this rule. Mrs. Rhett said to her, "Miss Iola, will you tell me what you think of the following story told me by a lady here yesterday?" She then related an incredible yarn, such as we have all had to listen to some time or the other from neurotic and hysterical people. The reply was, "Is the woman insane?" But, catching herself up, she went on, "I cannot tell, Mrs. Rhett, unless I investigate all the facts, but I think the lady who told you that must require medical attention." This is a common experience, and is one of the most touching incidents of the séance room. Nothing is so pathetic as to hear a spirit sobbing in the trumpet when an unhappy man or woman has come to have speech with them. Exaggerated grief has the worst effect upon discarnate spirits. It prevents them from making any progress, and they haunt the earth until they are assured that those they have left are reasonably reconciled to their loss. It shocks anti-spiritists, who misunderstand the philosophy of the subject, to hear laughter in a séance room. As a matter of fact, laughter gives the best possible vibrations, and assists the display of phenomena more than any other sound. The violoncello, the organ, singing, and the graphophone, all are good, but laughter is best. It is a selfish act to retard the elevation of a spirit by despairing grief, when you know that there has only been a veil dropped between you, and that in a few years you will see your friend again, unchanged except for the progress he or she has made in the interval. And it happens frequently that a spirit in the lower spheres expresses the greatest gratitude for a meeting with those on the earth plane, and leaves asking for the prayers or thoughts of the sitters. All North American Indians were spiritists in their earth lives, and hover about the country so familiar to them. One or two will be found in every band belonging to a medium. They assist behind the scenes, so to speak, and intervene when the circle is too concentrated or quiet. Laughter loud and long is usually the result of their advent. The sitters are all roused again and diverted from that worst of all habits, thinking too much of some particular spirit whom they wish to see. The spheres and realms, I have to confess that I do not now know precisely what a sphere is, though I am sure of my ground when I mention realms. A realm is a position of spiritual advancement, the chamber of the soul. To this all controls agree, but I have not been able to ascertain exactly what is meant by a sphere. As far as I understand it, the name is used to designate a condition, or place, of understanding, a knowledge of the powers which spirits can attain by diligent study of the vibrations in the next state of consciousness. There are no realms in any sphere below the fifth, some say below the sixth, and a spirit may attain the sixth sphere without being in any realm.